You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. Could I have your attention, please? My name is Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies here at Brookings. It's my real pleasure to welcome you here. That's one of my duties this morning, to welcome you, and thank you for coming. My second duty is to commend the four visiting fellows of the CNAPS program this spring, who have really enriched our program and added to my knowledge of some very interesting subjects. And third is to pass the baton over to my esteemed colleague, Vonda Felba Brown, who will moderate the discussion today. And Vonda, the floor is yours.
Good morning, and thank you, Richard. It is a very great pleasure to be here with you this morning, and it is really great to see the interest in Washington in issues of organized crime in East Asia. Often discussions on crime in Washington center on Latin America with some very good reasons. That's Latin America is, of course, our close neighbor that we are deeply connected in various ways, and a lot of transnational crime in the Americas flow indeed between the two continents within the Western Hemisphere. But increasingly, transnational crime is, in fact, transnational, very global, and certainly developments in organized crime in East Asia impinge critically upon public safety in other regions, often in very deep and surprising ways. And also, East Asia is very interesting for providing a great scope of lesson from the field of counter-narcotics to the field of illegal logging, human smuggling. And so learning from how the crime there has evolved and how responses have evolved is very important. I am delighted to share the podium today with our visiting fellows. I will not give extensive introductions. You have the welcoming statement, and so you can see their bios. Let me just say that they are all very prominent experts in the fields they'll be talking about. And it's been a great pleasure, not just for Richard, but for us at Brookings. And you'll see this morning also for you to hear their comments and lessons and recommendations from the topics of transnational crime. Because we have so many presentations, I'll really stop with my remarks and just let you know a little bit about the format. Each of us will talk about a different topic for about 10 minutes. And then we'll open it up for a question and answer period. Nelson Chang, who will start, who is a police officer from Hong Kong, where he focuses on money laundering, counter-narcotics, and other serious crime, will open the discussion with issues discussing transnational crime. Then Jaime Chan, a prominent anthropologist from China, we'll talk about human smuggling across the border between Myanmar and China. And this will be a good segue to Sandy, who will talk about human smuggling in Taiwan. Then Al will speak briefly about illegal logging and illegal trade in wildlife in East Asia and the Asia-Pacific region. And finally, Tuan will a little bit transition us from crime per se to talk about nuclear proliferation in the region. But I think that nuclear proliferation is a good ending to the presentation before we start the discussion, because it is one of the markets where there are great levels of complexities. What is illegal? How does illegality nonetheless interact with political imperatives? At what point do illegal economies become truly illegal? At what point do illegal economies become nonetheless socially or politically acceptable? And indeed, these same considerations emerge in all of our discussions, but rather prominently, I suspect, in Duan's. With this, Nelson, please, if you can start.
Yeah, thanks, Wanda, for the introduction. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This presentation, or my presentation, is just to give you a short overview of my research with Brookings, and which is basically to measure the effectiveness of the financial investigations or money laundering investigation regimes of the U.S. and Hong Kong in combating transnational crime. Which is basically a comparison study between the Hong Kong regime and the U.S. regime to see whether they are effective in combating transnational crime, and also to identify respective strengths and weaknesses for reference by each other and by other international law enforcement agencies. But before I move on to the details, I would like to make you clear on one point, is that although the research is about financial investigations or money laundering investigation, but the focus or the assessments is on the effectiveness in combating transnational crime or combating organized crime, because and not on the anti-money laundering, because anti-money laundering is only a means to an end. Anti-money laundering is not the end. The end or the underlying purpose of anti-money laundering actually is to combat organized crime or combat crime. So that's why I put the focus on measuring the assessments measuring the effectiveness in combating organized crime rather than on anti-money laundering. So organized crime, with globalizations and advances in information technologies, nowadays criminal activities are getting more transnational in nature, more mobile, efficient, and secretive in their operations. Nowadays, criminals, they exploit very well the jurisdictional incompatibility to create a very low-risk environment for them and also for their criminal activities, and also they insulate themselves very well from the crime they plan and organize. International law enforcement efforts have been very good at interdicting the criminal activities, I would say, or I believe, but only with the arrest of some low-level operative, only with the arrest of some funmen, the efforts have not been very good at arresting or prosecuting the prime offender or the mastermind behind, and not good at confiscating or getting their money. And international law enforcement community, they generally agree that an effective law enforcement effort have to be able to interdicting the criminal activities, getting or prosecuting the mastermind or the prime offender, and getting their money, i.e. going after the crime, the people, and the money. So international law enforcement community, they generally or gradually aware that in order to effectively get the money and to get the people, get the prime offender, they have to rely more on financial investigations or money laundering investigation to make them more effective in getting the people and the money. Because bear in mind that the people or the prime offender, they insulate very well from the crime they organize and plan. So this is the background leading to my research, and for the purpose of my research, I therefore need to examine and compare the Hong Kong regime and the U.S. regime to see whether they can facilitate and enable their respective law enforcement agents to go after the people and money. And for that purpose, I need to examine some of the relevant legal and practical institutions of the two regimes, which include their money laundering offenses, the SS forfeitures regimes, their investigative powers, techniques, their financial intelligence capability, and some of the practice relating to their domestic collaborations and international cooperations. But because of the limitation of time, I don't have enough time to go through all the findings to you, but I would like to highlight two of the more significant findings relating to or in respect to the money laundering offenses and the SS forfeitures regimes. For money laundering offenses, my research found that the offenses, the U.S. money laundering offenses, is very complex. The many qualifications of the offense makes the offenses very limited in scope, and actually it's very difficult to prove. Whereas, on the other hand, the Hong Kong money laundering offense is very simple, very wide and basic, and is easy to prove. In fact, in Hong Kong nowadays, we very often use money laundering offenses to get the prime offender the mastermind, and has been very successful. And if Hong Kong money laundering offense gets similar limitations of the U.S. offense, those successful cases wouldn't have been successful in Hong Kong. As for the SS forfeiture regime, it is on the opposite. The I found or the research found that the U.S. regime is very comprehensive. It got civil, criminal, and administrative forfeitures, and has been and the law enforcement has makes very impressive result. Each year they had 20,000 cases involving substantial amount, whereas the forfeitures regime in Hong Kong is very limited. And in Hong Kong, we only have the criminal confiscations or criminal forfeiture, which means that, you know, before we can confiscate the assets of the criminal, we need to have the conviction. So that makes the regime very limited and restricted. And the result or the enforcement figures has not been very impressive compared to the 20,000 cases in the U.S. Hong Kong, they have 50 cases a year. So my conclusion, but those findings is just two of the many findings I got from my research, because I don't have too much time to go through each and every findings I got. But my conclusion I would like to tell you is that, and obviously that U.S. is, or U.S. Money laundering investigations regime is very good at going after the money, but may not be good at going after the people, for the reason that I just explained to you. And on the other hand, Hong Kong is good at going after the people because of the robustness of the money laundering offenses, but may not be good at going after the money. Because as to, you know, which regime is more superior than the others, I cannot draw any conclusion because they have their respective strengths and weaknesses. I cannot say for sure that, you know, which regime is more effective because of the respective strengths and weaknesses, and I can also not say for sure that they are not effective. Because, you know, if I look at the enforcement figure, actually the enforcement figures are really good. For example, in U.S., every year they prosecute around 3,000 people for money laundering. But I don't know, or I am not sure, because I don't have that information, is among these 3,000 people, how many of them are prime offender, or how many of them are just fund men, or, you know, just money launderer? I'm not sure, but just look at the enforcement figures. It's not too bad. In Hong Kong, every year we successfully prosecute 400 people for money laundering. And I know that many of them are prime offender. But I can say for sure, although I'm not sure many things, but I can say for sure that if the deficiency or the witnesses which identify by my research are not to be fixed very soon, then the two regime will not remain to be effective or relevant in a very near future. I got some recommendations, and for the U.S., obviously, the U.S. authority may wish to widen the scope of their money laundering offense. The Hong Kong authority may wish to get a review of their assets forfeiture regime to see whether Hong Kong should introduce civil forfeiture in Hong Kong in their regime. I also got some recommendations for international organizations such as the Financial Action Task Force. Financial Action Task Force is the highest authority on anti-money laundering. They set standards and also evaluate member jurisdictions as to their effectiveness in implementing those standards. And those standards we normally or commonly call recommendations. So my recommendation to Financial Action Task Force is that they should put more regard to the underlying purpose of anti-money laundering when they formulate or revise their recommendations and their evaluation methodologies. The other recommendation to another international organization is the United Nations. United Nations adopt the UNATOC, the Conventions Against Transnational Organized Crime in 2001. They set the standards. There are 41 articles, basically are international standards against transnational organized crime, including corruption. But since the adoption of the convention, they have done very little about how to ensure the member countries to effectively implement the articles, because they still haven't formulated the evaluation methodologies and still formulate a mechanism to evaluate and to, if they found member country failed to implement the article or the standards, they haven't have any censoring mechanism. You know, a convention without a censoring mechanism is just like a tiger without teeth. So I would urge the United Nations to put in place as soon as possible a evaluation and censoring mechanism to ensure member country to implement the articles of the conventions of the UNATOC. So these basically are my recommendations arising from my research, and this basically concludes my short presentations. And this is my last day in Brookings, so I don't use the Brookings email. This is my email with the Hong Kong Police. So if you would like to have further discussion on this, you may by all means communicate with me through this email. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nelson. You can see that Nelson is not only a very prominent law enforcement officer and a great researcher, but that he's also a very good law enforcement officer who stayed to the 10-minute time allotted to us without my having to wave any flag. So thank you very much for that, as well as for a fascinating talk. And one of the very fascinating conclusions, of course, was about the difference in the U.S. And the Hong Kong system, and that has critical implications for how broadly interdiction is thought about. Should interdiction be going after the money? Can we eliminate or reduce crime by sapping the money? Or should interdiction focus on high-value target, going after the masterminds and the primary offenders? So many great conversations, I'm sure, to follow with Nelson.
Yes,
thank you.
Okay, thanks, Vander. Thanks, Richard. Thank you for coming. My topic today is trafficking women across the Yunnan-Myanmar border in translational migration era China. Let's start from a story. Start from a Burmese girl story, Yi Ye. Yi Ye experienced deception, transported several places in China, and sold by smugglers and forced to marry a Chinese single man. I think you can read a lot of stories about the women's victims in human trafficking. But for social science research, we need to raise more issues. I think there are several issues that need to be confused in this case. The first, the Asian women's livelihoods. They have to face the traditional rice cultivation to industry. And the women become more easy to mobility. And it is obviously women can cross border to different countries. This has familiarized the mobility and the migration. The second, China is a destination for Asian female immigrants. We all know China is a traditional immigrant sending countries, but now it's faced the transformation to as a receiving country. But does China government get ready to deal with this irregular female immigration? That's we need to address these questions. Smuggled and trafficked women are often forced to marry Chinese single men. So what is the social dynamics? This we need to know. And human smuggling and trafficking across China-Myanmar border. What, how the theorist, and what is the meaning for the China's government to deal with the human trafficking issues? The forces of human trafficking is huge profits, and the transnational crime cross network of friends and their family. Regional cross-border crime features, I think. And also 4P, paradigm, prevention, protection, prosecution, and partnership in fighting human trafficking. So how the China government practice the 4P? So my recommendation for the policy is toward the legalization of irregular migration. The data come from the national population census last year. I think that the number is significant. The Myanmar, around 40,000 Burmese people already lived in China at least 3 months or maybe longer. So now the Myanmar is on the rank number 4 in the top 10 countries of foreigners residing in China. And according to the borders survey, 70% are women. So this feminized immigration for Asian women. But for Myanmar, I think the situation is more worse because of long-term civil war in this area, this drug abuse issues, and also HIV/AIDS epidemic issues. Women forced to mobility to choose a new life. I think it is this reason pushed women mobility or immigrants. Burmese women, they already lived in China at least 10 years. There are some Burmese community. In one village, more than 100 Burmese women lived in same village. So this we can see that this photos come from the news report, and this a push reason. But if we come back to the China, we can see the poor reason. That's more still significant. I think there. As a consequence of one-child policy, this is women missing, actually. According to Hudson's research, there's around 1 million female missing during last decade every year. And I think it is the best sex selective abortion. And the number will be 33 million. Women shortage in marriage. So we can, from the number, we can see the how serious these issues. Chinese desperate single man, also named Guangguan in Chinese character, is very meaningful, cultural meaningful. This Guangguan means they are failure in life. If you cannot get married a woman, that means that's the failure for a man. So there's a single man, Petrus brides around the world, actually. This is a map in China. But we can see domestic Petrus from the west part of China. Normally they are undeveloped and the poor provinces in the to east provinces and from the south to north. So these are domestic pictures. And also Chinese single men, the pictures brides international. Russia from Russia in the North Korea. And also from the south, from Vietnam, Laos, and Myanmar. I think it is southwest China, cross-border with Myanmar, is faced a very difficult situation because this corner, a little bit like the Mexico border in United States, in the traditional this corridor of drug smuggling in the gun smuggling. Now it's a human smuggling. So these issues, actually, these are relative and combined together. So there's a more complexity issues. And another reason is this area is ethnic minority people live there, like the Kachin, Karen, Shan, and the Dilang. There's many ethnic minority people, they cross border living in both countries. In their traditional, they have their relatives cross border. They have their traditional trade network. So even now the new drugs come into China, they still very affiliate this traditional commercial network. This network based on their relatives and also their ethnicity. So this, if we see the profits of the human trafficking in this region, we can see there's a big issues. Now the women's price increased so quickly. Okay, 2 minutes. Okay, so we can see how serious this. In the China government actually attended the international cooperation against the human trafficking, but China is placed on the tier 2 watch list during this last week. Announcement trafficking person report 2011. China government took the several implementation plans for the MPA. But we can see some numbers. These trafficking cases and the rescue victims and their suspect arrest during the twice national plan of against the trafficking. But we can see the victims rescue number is get low down. So that's a need to focus. What's the reason? I think this data come from this cross-border county police office. This local office, they get assistance with more than 30 provinces to help repatriate victims back to Myanmar. So we can see Myanmar victims, they already lived around the whole countries. So this, I think the policy blind is like the female, they are disadvantaged in migration. Many countries encourage the high educated and high skilled people and the technical people to migrate, get a policy for support them. But for the female, the less than many support from the policy. So now this marriage migrated women from Asian countries, they still cannot get the authority from the government, get the legal status in their legal marriage certification, in the legal protection. So that means they are now it's Sanfei Renyuan, which means illegal to entry, illegal to residing, and illegal to work. My conclusion is blind policy in the black market when together, it make the issues more worse. Undocumented unregistered marriage and undocumented marriage immigrants stimulate the growth of human trafficking crime across China borders. And now the local government explored some flexible policies like the blue card, register for encourage for the foreign brides to register to the government, and they can after the register they get the blue card, they can share their medical insurance and subsidy from the local government. I think that's a very important step toward the legalization of the irregular migration in China. So this reduce human trafficking and illegal migration depends innovation migration strategies and the formulation of immigration law, strengthening capability in mechanism building effective manage effective transnational migration, both legal and illegal. So these are my policy recommendation. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Jaime. Again, another fascinating presentation, and one cannot think about some of the parallels and differences in the U.S. debate about how to deal with illegal immigration, much broader, of course, and some of the issues and complexities facing China. And further on, specifically the trafficking of women, Sandy, a police officer from Taiwan, will continue.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to talk about a little bit about Taiwan's anti-human trafficking efforts with the findings of the challenges and recommendations. And my email address is at the bottom of this. If you have any further question after my presentation, please feel free to contact me. Human trafficking is a form of modern-day slavery, and as a matter of fact, it's also a gender-biased violence because most of the victims are women and children. And it's a byproduct of globalization and also a biggest challenge faced by all the law enforcement community in the world. And Taiwan is no exception. To respond to this change, this challenge, the U.S. Department, United States passed the Trafficking Victim Protection Act in year 2000. And at the same year, United Nations also passed a similar protocol to prevent, suppress, and punish trafficking in persons. And there are rising number of research to talk about the push and pull factors of rise of human trafficking. In general, those trafficking syndicates prey on poverty, despair, war, crisis, economic disparity, social discrimination, gender inequality, natural disaster. In other words, they prey on the most vulnerable population in the world. And so with the fact of growing globalization, Taiwan as a country with only 23 million population, now we have increasing number of international immigrants living in Taiwan as a long-term resident. As statistics show, the majority are foreign spouses. We also have a big amount of foreign neighbors, and another 220,000 international immigrants come in as students, employees, and family members of Taiwanese citizens. And so accompanied with the growing immigrant population, Taiwan also faces similar problems, the rising cases of forced prostitution and forced labor. In the map of global sex trade, Taiwan was identified as destination, source, and transit countries. So let's break down the types of human trafficking in Taiwan in terms of the destination, source, and transit. As a destination country, the victims of human trafficking come, enter Taiwan with legal or illegal status. They come in as marriage immigrants, or they come in as foreign labor, but most of the foreign laborers are guest workers. And some of them, came in as student or visitors or entertainer, but their legal status expired. But as a source country, our younger generation also faced the lure of the human trafficking group. They can be tricked by advertisement on newspaper or internet, so they can be tricked with fraud, free trips, or working holidays, or even meet someone on internet, and they fall into victim as human trafficking, in forced prostitution in Australia, United States, United Kingdom, and Japan. And also, Taiwan serves as a transit because there are more than 100 countries now recognize Taiwan without with a visa waiver program. So the syndicates would use the stolen Taiwanese identity or Taiwanese passport to help to facilitate the human trafficking. So the United States State Department issued a trafficking person report every year to evaluate the country's performance in prosecution, prevention, and protection in terms of human trafficking. Taiwan actually had ups and downs. We were first recognized as the best countries from 2001 to 2004 because we had a pretty advanced, progressive Child and Juvenile Sexual Transaction Prevention Act stipulated in 1995. But we also, we were, downgraded further even to the Tier 2 watch list in 2006. But since then, we have adopted a lot of very responsive and effective measures to counter human trafficking. So now we are back into Tier 1 again. Just this week, on Monday, the U.S. State Department released a trafficking person report to 2011. Taiwan again was rated as a Tier 1 country. Taiwan and South Korea are the only two nations in Asia to be rated at Tier 1. And if you have time, probably look into the country narratives. Okay. Anyway, I only have 2 minutes, so I'm just going to skip it anyway. We have recognized by State Department and with the 4P, prevention, prosecution, protection, and partnerships, paradigms. We almost drag every department in Taiwan into this fight against human trafficking to provide many services to the victims. You know, we have social worker to accompany victims. We have foreign labor hotlines with 4 different languages. We have shelters for victims. We even provide a variety of self-employment activities to help those victims of forced labor or forced prostitutes to stand up. And we brought in experts from international communities or locally. We had comprehensive public awareness campaign. And we also have political wills from the very top. Our president signed an agreement to fight against human trafficking. But we have our challenges, mainly because the law is so new. So the judicial part, the judge, they are still stick to the very conventional rule of evidence. So it's very difficult to convict or sentence the traffic with the severe sentence that they deserve. And also, those victims from sending country, they were exported back in their sending countries. As you can see on the slides, the Vietnamese worker, they're paying up to $7,000 U.S. dollar for their brokerage fees. And with the very special political situation of Taiwan, we have problem to continue our legal efforts with the sending country. And that's why, I have come up with some recommendation. I think we have to continue, strengthen the professionalism of, to the criminal justice system. And we have to enhance the sharing of information and experience, with our local, community and with our international, counterparts. By saying that, I like to share our, experience to, climbing up from the very bottom, the watch list, tier two watch list to tier one, the experience with our sending countries and with our, big brothers that like China, because they have been staying at, tier two watch list like forever. So that's my conclusion. Okay, thank you.
It is a sign of a great researcher that she can continue very succinct and make critical observation even when disturbed by external forces such as time running out. And, Sandy's presentation was fascinating in many ways, including because there is now an important debate going on Congress, how much to resource, if at all, the State Department Bureau that is focused on human smuggling. And it is very interesting to see that the State Department yearly evaluation has had an important impact, at least in Taiwan, albeit given perhaps particular sensitivities in Taiwan because of its political situation and relations with the United States. But nonetheless, hearing when the evaluation works and when it doesn't should be a critical part of Congress's considerations about how much and in what way to fund the Bureau. I now have perhaps the hardest task of policing myself for the next 10 minutes as I talk about illegal logging and illegal trade in wildlife. So, Sandy, feel free to return the favor and punch me when I run out of my 10 minutes. Thank you.
I'm a law enforcement.
Indeed. Both illegal logging and illegal trade in wildlife are acutely prevalent in East Asia and Asia more broadly. But they are at the same time at the bottom of interest for government regulatory policies and often for at the bottom of law enforcement priorities. Yet they each reach critical levels in the region, often in with great cost, economic cost, as well as environmental cost, often irretrievable loss of species and biodiversity. And this in a region that is one of the key biodiversity hotspots in the world, where when a species goes, it's lost forever with great impacts on the overall ecosystem and great impacts on the well-being of human beings as well. I have two new papers available when you came in. One is on illegal logging in Asia-Pacific and one is on illegal trade in wildlife in Southeast Asia. They are both also available at our Brookings website. Each paper discusses the definitional conundrum about what illegality in these two illegal economies means and what this means for law enforcement. It discusses the various and complex threats posed by each of the illegal economies, its drivers, structure of the illegal industry in each case, the actions adopted by government so far. And as well as each has a very extensive section on evaluating the cost benefits, efficacy, and implications of various supply side and demand side measures, both for the timber economy and for wildlife. I don't really have an opportunity to get into details on either of the economies. Let me just give you some flavor of the arguments and issues that each paper highlights. In both cases, there has been a tightening of government regulation and some increase in enforcement. These are important, yet both economies continue to be characterized by still very weak regulatory frameworks, very minimal law enforcement, and often very minimal penalties associated with violating existing laws. And this in cases where the pace of unsustainable logging, despite some slowing down, continues in the Asia-Pacific region at sustainable and environmentally damaging ways. Often to the extent that we have seen slowing down, it has been less as a result of demand or supply policies adopted, but more as a result of particular areas becoming simply commercially logged out. There is simply no more forest available for logging. Which is not to say that there has been no improvement in policy in these that have, but often their impact has been smaller than we would hope for. In the case of wildlife trade, the situation is perhaps even more dire, with the volume and diversity of species traded reaching phenomenal and unprecedented levels. In many ways, the forests of Asia and increasingly four Asian markets elsewhere in the world are becoming sucked out, siphoned off wildlife. Yet despite the fact that enforcement often doesn't prioritize these two economies, the nature and level of criminality, organized crime penetration, institutional corruption is really no different than in other illegal economies. And in some places, illegal logging in Indonesia is in fact one of the critical criminal challenges that, for example, Indonesia faces. Similarly, in Burma, illegal trade in wildlife is intimately connected to the networks of human smuggling and drug smuggling that Jaime was talking about. And in both cases, both illegal economies are also linked to militancy and provide funding for terrorist groups. China is at the epicenter and pivot of world's deforestation, illegal logging, and timber processing, and in fact also the world's largest wood workshop, processing both illegal and legal timber, not just from the region, but increasingly from the world. Along with China, the United States, Europe, Japan, and increasingly India and the Middle East are very large, robust consumers of world timber, and many of them are growing consumers of world timber. And often when regulations succeed in improving deforestation and scaling down illegal logging in one locale, the trade is simply transferred, the undesirable activities are simply transferred to another locale in a systematic deforestation of one country after another. And we see a similar pattern with wildlife trade, where at the core of which really lies a very rapidly expanding demand for wildlife. Much of it is driven by an increasing affluence of many previously poor countries. Demand for wildlife is interestingly bifurcated between two markets. On the one important consumer group are a marginalized community for whom wildlife meat is frequently the only source of protein. But a second important group are increasingly affluent consumers, often in China or among Chinese communities around the world, who consume wildlife for a variety of reasons, including critically as part of traditional Chinese medicine. That is supposed to have both vast curative powers, it's a sign of prestige, it's supposed to have various health benefits, sexual benefits, and it's very much a deeply ingrained symbol of status. And critically drives expanding demand for wildlife. So addressing the wildlife trade, the illegal wildlife trade, one needs to think very carefully about how one will address each of the different demand markets, and policies directed for reducing protein-driven consumption will not be effective when one thinks about policies, when one thinks about trade associated with traditional Chinese medicine, for example. Let me now just give you some of the flavor of the policy effects and considerations I discuss with the two papers. There is a real need to improve law enforcement and intensify law enforcement. But at the same time, one of the conclusions in both cases is that there is only so much greater law enforcement can do. The structure of both illegal economies is not one that easily lends itself to effective law enforcement. And indeed, much of the conservation measures for both timber and forests and for wildlife will need to lie elsewhere, both in the demand markets as well as in other conservation practices. In the case of wildlife, for example, there actually I should also mention that unfortunately in both cases, there is really no good silver bullet. each of the different supply or different demand policies come with quite significant costs, and the trade-offs are often very acute. And one of the overwhelming lessons of the paper is that specificity with respect to local cultural institutional settings is critically important. And in the case of wildlife, specificity with respect to the ecological requirements of the species is also very much needed. And so it's very difficult to derive effective regulatory systems at the broad national level that apply both to wildlife and or timber. For example... For example, one of the difficult questions in wildlife trade is whether one should adopt bans or, in fact, encourage legal supply of the particular species. Bans have advantages. They simplify law enforcement. They can perhaps highlight the critical status of the species. But the downside is that they reduce economic incentives for communities and stakeholders to preserve the species. And while bans have often been ineffective, in some cases they have worked very well, but frequently they haven't. But the same applies to assuring legal supply through either farming or legal managed hunting. Such policies give a community, farmers, ranchers, stake to preserve the species and the ecosystem. But often this self-regulation is not sufficient and the species are in fact driven to extinction. So in both cases, there are some spectacular successes in the case of licensing crocodilians, for example, and spectacular failures in the case of licensing tiger farming in China, for example. Similarly, a favored approach these days to manage illegal trade in timber is the use of timber certification, essentially to designate that the logged and traded timber has been sourced and transported in a legal or sustainable way, and that illegal timber has not been mixed into the legal timber. But certification faces some of the same difficulties that law enforcement does. It's extraordinarily resource-intensive, very difficult to conduct effectively, notwithstanding the availability of DNA testing these days, and more often than not cannot really identify it systematically given the volumes of timber traded, whether timber is legal or not. And if certification is issued improperly, it can, in fact, whitewash consumer conscience and increase undesirable demand. And a key part of the certification schemes, as they often exist today, is that they focus on the legality of wood. But the fact that timber is logged in accordance with legal or international laws does not necessarily mean that it is logged sustainably. In other words, legal timber can be as environmentally damaging as illegal one. That said, some important developments have taken place last year or over the past several years in the case of the logging industry. In Cancun in December of last year, the big breakthrough was the agreement to adopt what's called RED, reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, essentially rich countries agreeing to pay poor countries for keeping their forests standing. And the United States over the past few years has adopted laws that prohibit the importation of illegal timber, and the European Union has adopted new due diligence standards that demand that importers of timber check its legality. Again, both mechanisms face great challenges in terms of enforcement and identifications that the obligation and availability of prosecution mechanism does not necessarily redress. Moreover, how effective the RED schemes will be yet remains to be seen, and there are major critical issues not answered, such as what will be the funding, who will fund the payoff scheme. Will there ever be developed stable and sufficiently large carbon credits? What will be the assurance that the benefits will trickle down from the governments to the poor communities who often are the principal loggers or the first level loggers? As well as critically, what will the price structure be if natural unlocked forests are not valued much, much more than reforested forests or monoculture plantations, then governments may have the tendency to deforest anyway, collapse the ecosystem, and get the carbon payments through reforestation, which will perhaps reduce carbon emissions, but will not address biodiversity issues. The both the papers conclude with a set of broad recommendations that I will not get into and yield the floor to Tuan, but these are just some of the flavors of the complexities and difficulties of managing well each illegal economy, even as they have a very important and often ignored costs for society and the planet. And Tuan will now talk about perhaps the greatest danger that the planet faces related to nuclear smuggling and the dangers of nuclear smuggling and its intensity in Asia.
Thank you, Vanda. Well, okay. It doesn't matter. My topic is not specifically about crimes, as other speakers said, but somehow very much related to trafficking, because this is a hot topic now elsewhere in the world, but frankly speaking, it remains low priorities in Southeast Asia, even in essence is very worrisome, you know. So in Southeast Asia, we know that geographical location of Southeast Asia is opened very much to trafficking because of its porous borders. You know, we have mainland Southeast Asia, we have maritime Southeast Asia, but somehow this is a very fertile soil for trafficking of a number of illicit items. Which could range from nucleus, radiological items to chemicals, biological items, or dual-use technologies. And Southeast Asia is both as an origin exporters of technologies and sensitive items, and also the transit and transshipment hubs of trafficking of all these items. As an origin exporters, we know that Southeast Asia lies in one of the most the world's busiest shipping lanes. So the trade volumes transits through Southeast Asia is huge. And Southeast Asian countries themselves are export-oriented economies, most of them. And I have some figures here of trade in high-tech items in Southeast Asia, for example. So to show how, high-tech trade is in Southeast Asia's in the composition of high trade. In the overall exports of Southeast Asia, for example, Malaysia's high-tech trade accounts significantly in its total trade volumes. At its highest point, is 63% in 2001, most recently is around 40%. Amongst other things, these items could include Eurospade, computers, scientific instruments, you name it, all these kind of new use technologies. And as a transit and transshipment hub, Southeast Asia has a number of seaports, river ports, airports, and it makes Southeast Asia very convenient locations for transit and transshipments of illicit trades in the regions. And the recent cases show that the problems has become much more serious now. Here I only cite two most recent cases in the last 3 months, which involved suspected illicit highly sensitive materials. One case, it just last month, actually, a seizure of containers, enrolled from Northeast Asia's from North Korea to Myanmar, for example, and the others, back to in March by Malaysians, interdicting a ship where they seized a consignment for enrolled to Iran. The investigation is underway, but the initial indications show that this is kind of very sensitive technologies that could involve in the weapons programs. And in Southeast Asia, we still face a very big problem with the law enforcement. You know, not only in perhaps in China's, in the in elsewhere in the case of human trafficking, but in illicit trade in Southeast Asia, law enforcement is very worrisome. You know, even those international treaties, conventions are very much there, but most of the countries in Southeast Asia are not yet part of it. Many of important international regime, so law enforcement system is fairly weak in Southeast Asia. Is posing a very troubling problems. There's of course some existing mechanisms in Southeast Asia to combat this illicit trade in Southeast Asia. In terms of international regime and framework, we have IAEA safeguards, including additional protocols. We have NPT, we have UN Security Council Resolution 1540, and we use mostly with export control, non-state actors, and we have ad hoc PSI, Proliferation Security Initiative, led by United States. And at regional levels, we have Southeast Asian nuclear weapons free zones, which deals partly with the non-proliferations of weapons of mass destruction. And we have ASEAN's directors, generals of custom. We have ASEAN's police. We have ARF, Asia Pacific Custom and Trade, so on and so forth. And at national level, we have, of course, some countries do have so-called export control lists, which specifically deal with export items, particularly the sensitive export items. To facilitate, understanding and raising awareness among Southeast Asian countries in East Asia, they have the track to mechanism where they promote exchange of academics and discussions on the issues. We have CISCAP, Council on Security Cooperation Asia Pacific, a study group on WMD, and Asian export control seminars hosted by Japan. The national efforts so far are, I think, limited, except Malaysia and Singapore. These two countries have been leading the efforts on countering proliferations and illicit trade in Southeast Asia. Singapore, for example, was the first countries in Southeast Asia to adopt a Strategic Goods Control Act to specifically counter proliferation of WMD. In that act, there's a control list drawn on from various international regimes and conventions, such as missile technology control regimes, nuclear supplier group, Australian group, Wasana arrangement, things like that. And more importantly, it has provisions, the so-called catch-on provisions. This is a very kind of additional extended sort of provisions to deal with export control, and Malaysia followed suit a year ago by adopting the similar strategic trade bill, which also based on lots of articles and agreements and drawn on from EU and UN lists. And also it provides catch-all provisions. So these are two first legal frameworks adopted by Southeast Asian countries to counter proliferations and illicit trade in Southeast Asia. And now the challenge ahead, in combating illicit materials in Southeast Asia, I see it in two layers. Number one, within each country's the internal problems with combating illicit traffickings. First, I think there are a number of problems over here. I just throw out some serious one. I think. First of all, I think is the capacity constraints. I mean, most of Southeast Asian countries are relatively poor, maybe except Singapore, Malaysia, to some extent Thailand. Well, so you know, they lack resources and expertise, professionalism, you name it. It's not only in these areas, but other areas. This is a big problem. And then the low level of awareness and attention to this problem in Southeast Asia. If you ask most policy makers in Southeast Asia, you know, I would suspect that they don't really know much about this kind of illicit traffickings, you know, particular things related to nuclear, chemical, biological things, you know. So, and then we have the very kind of non-cooperations from private sectors, what we call non-state actors. Because when we talk about illicit trade in Southeast Asia, you know, we talk mostly about export control, and we have to work with private sectors, you know, the exporters, you know, the companies, but they are not very cooperative, you know, frankly speaking, because they are very much concerned with, you know, with their trade. You know, they say, you know, they have to show the additional, you know, burdens on you know, export and other regulations, and then insufficient and an ineffective export control system, as I mentioned earlier. Most countries in Southeast Asia do not have a national export control list. You know, 10 Southeast Asian countries, but 8 out of which don't have this yet. Then the second layer is you know, external problems. You know, first of all, is the harmonization of national laws and regulations. ASEAN is going to build so-called communities, ASEAN communities, based on three pillars. But still, you know, they don't really elaborate how to make, for example, political and security, you know, communities when they all these structures do not really provide good mechanism for, you know, combating these issues, I mean the trafficking. And then we have international cooperation problems, you know, because, you know, if you talk different language, you cannot cooperate, you know. In Southeast Asia, people do things in a different ways, you know, with the discrepancies in legal frameworks and practices, you know, custom, things like that. So when it comes to international cooperation with UN and with others, international organizations and countries, it really have problems. I think my time is up. I'm looking forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Tuan, for highlighting the complexities of non-proliferation enforcement in Southeast Asia, a region sandwiched between South Asia and regions among the most intense proliferation on the one hand, and East Asia with its difficult balances of some opaque, some very declared proliferation and rising nuclear arsenals. I'll now open it for question and answer period. Please raise your hand and identify yourself. Wait for the microphone. And I would urge you to take particularly advantage of my wonderful colleagues. It is the last day at Brookings. They have enormously enriched our Brookings community here. And so feel free to direct many questions to them. I'll be around and easier to get hold of for a longer period of time. So please.
Hi, I'm Monty Martin, and I have so many questions, but I'll just stick to one, to Jaime Shen. And this involves your really dramatic figure that by 2020, 33 million men will not have wives. And in terms of China's harmonious society, does the government really have an incentive to crack down on human trafficking? Because it seems that if 33 million men don't have wives and no real prospects and their families are really pressuring them, that could lead to internal social unrest. And I'd just like to hear your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Yes, I think the issues is really beyond our, you know, perspective, you know. I think that there's a big challenge for China government. Actually, I worry about their, you know, China now is on the tier two. I think the watch list, you know, there's very difficult to keep. Just now, sending machine, this China government keep their watch list tier two 7 years. I think this really challenges for the government. For some countries, maybe it's easy to keep their, you know, watch list the first or second. But for the China government, there's only one issues in their domestic, you know, when China need to face many issues like their during the social transformation, you know. So I think that this is also reason I put their policy suggestion for this because immigration is very important tools like the legalization of the irregular immigrants. This I think that's a very I hope that's a very effective tools to deal with the issues actually.
I probably can, you know, add on some more comments on this. We actually share some, you know, similar problem. Mm-hmm. It's a common issue that the Asian culture value son more, you know, more than a daughter. Yeah. So if the family can only afford one or two child, they would just keep the boys. So we also have a shortage on the wife, you know. And that's why, you know, since we lifted the martial law in 1987, there's, you know, there are a lot of, you know, the Chinese mainland immigrants in 1949, you know, they started going back to China to marry Chinese women because of the women liberalization movement in Taiwan. Now there are more and more women stay single as a lifestyle. So this is going to be a big problem for many Asian countries to face, and I think we need a more comprehensive immigration policy, not only in China, but also in some other Asian countries too.
Thank you very much. My name is Michael Zorin. I'm the Director of U.S. Operations at Wildlife Alliance. I had a question for Dr. Felbab Brown as well as for Officer Cheng. One of the things you talked about was the linkages between the smuggling of wildlife and forest products and other illicit trade. Are police officers in South and East Asia trying to identify linkages between those who are smuggling endangered wildlife and forest products and those whose cargo may also contain drugs, weapons, humans, etc.? And if so, would that help drive the political will that you said was a shortcoming in responding to wildlife and forest smuggling if they could identify linkages to other illicit contraband?
The simple answer is yes. However, when one gets beyond the simplicity, there are actual great complexities. Although law enforcement, whether military forces or police forces that search for contraband have, in theory, the capacity to search for a variety of contraband, the difficulties, particularly with timber and wildlife, is that much of the trade is legal. And so what the challenge that the law enforcement faces, even when they identify networks of illegality, is determined that a particular element is illegal. That requires often a lot of training that officers that focus, for example, on nuclear smuggling or counter-narcotics do not have. And in fact, what we have learned about interdiction efforts in wildlife and timber, that having specialized units is critically important for a greater effectiveness of law enforcement. Now, the bigger issue is to what extent law enforcement forces can focus on identifying hubs and channels of smuggling. And there are overlaps, but there are also great differences. Jaime was talking about Ruili, for example, and we know that Ruili on the Myanmar side, Monglai is the hub of smuggling with variety of contrabands. So focusing on identifying the hubs could be perhaps a productive mechanism. But an important aspect of it is also to reward law enforcement officers for focusing on timber and wildlife, and that is frequently lacking. Often there are limited promotions. If any promotions is the part of law enforcement that is least resourced, the ability to rise to prominence is very significantly limited. That, of course, means for governments to change their view of whether wildlife or timber are important, and it becomes very politically tricky because many governments derive great benefits from tolerating the illegal economy or the grey economy existing alongside it.
I only had one comment is that actually it has been known that the criminal groups or criminal syndicate, they changed their structure a long time ago, that nowadays they don't have that sort of a well structure hierarchy. You know, they are now more on network. And also they are more opportunists, and they are what we call is poly commodities. They don't just expert in a certain type of crime, or they don't just expert in trafficking in drugs. They may at the same time or at other times also engage in some other activity. So law enforcement has long been well prepared to deal with this sort of change in criminal structure, and also to deal with this sort of poly commodities, opportunistic criminal syndicate or criminal network.
Hi, my name is Tim Wittig, and I just wanted to ask kind of the reverse of that previous question. What are the overlaps, especially between the trafficking networks and legitimate trade networks? Legitimate traders. So are these trafficking routes and markets controlled by people that are actually elites in legitimate trades, like happens in South Asia a lot? Or is there more of a bright line between the criminal activity and the legal trades? And I'd like to address my question particularly to the two gentlemen. Thanks.
Yeah, I totally agree that, and also there has been a observation that nowadays criminal they won't just do or engage in criminal activities. Very often they have criminal activities and also some legitimate business, so that they can mix them together, and also they can commingle the legitimate fund with the illegitimate fund, and that certainly create a challenge to law enforcement. But I also said that we law enforcement, in particular those in Hong Kong, has been well prepared for that. And we have been good at, or we have provided our officer with sufficient training so that they can able to separate, or they can able to identify illicit fund from a legal fund. Even though they are nowadays criminals are so good in commingling illicit proceeds with those legitimate funds from a legitimate business.
Just an example to amplify what Nelson just said about the combination between the legal and illegal activities. Take Vanda's case on illegal loggings in Southeast Asia. There's a lot of, the number of cases where you have a quotas on loggings. That means you are entitled, to log on a certain number of trees. But at the same time, you do illegal loggings, and you actually put them all together and in the same container or consignment. With on papers, you have like 1,000 metrics square, for example. So maybe you lock like 2,000, but on the same papers. And when you cross the borders, you show the papers, you get the seal. But at the same, you bribe the border control, border guards. You know, so that you know actually you have 2,000 meters metric square of ooze, but actually you are entitled only 1,000. So this kind of a combination between the illegal and legal thing is kind of very common popular that because at the end of the day they have to sell their products on the legal markets on the markets and some law enforcement actually can go after the certification. So when they go after the certification, you still have the papers on it. So you have the seal, the certification of the ooze, but actually it's not legal. Thank you.
Indeed, in the logging case, especially the logging industries, official logging industries in places like Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, are critical drivers of the illegal market and critical players on the illegal market.
I would also like to add one more thing is that apart from sufficient training, law enforcement should have necessary power or the offense just which I just mentioned in my presentation that even though law enforcement are able to separate or identify legitimate fund from those lawful business or lawful fund, they still need to have the offense. Powerful offense, robust offense to allow them to prosecute the criminal. Just like what I just said, that if your money laundering offense is very restrictive, even though you can identify, separate the illicit fund from the legitimate fund, you can still not able to prosecute the criminal for money laundering. So that's why, I really, would like to urge the U.S. authority to seriously consider to widen the scope of their offense. Because, even though you are able to separate them, you don't have the powerful offense to allow you to prosecute them.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Mr. Lloyd from the University of Maryland. Our topic for today talks about humans, money, and illicit materials. Now, let me talk about money. How true is the fact that a great number of fake U.S. dollars are manufactured in North Korea in huge volumes, and they are making Hong Kong as a distribution point to all parts of the world. Some rich Chinese businessmen are operating illegal money manufacturing in the Philippines and making Hong Kong as a hub or Singapore as a hub and as a distribution point to the other parts of the world. Can you please enlighten the public on this? Thank you.
When that allegations came, I was at that time was the head of the Financial Intelligence Unit of Hong Kong, and there was a delegation, U.S. delegation, come to visit Hong Kong. But at the end, they can't find any evidence to prove that the forged U.S. dollar has been in Hong Kong. So that is what I can say. You may not believe me, but you can check with your State Department and see whether what I'm saying is true or not. Well, I have no information about North Korea, so I cannot make any comments on North Korea.
Thank you. I'm Jin Ling, with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. My question is to Dr. Tha Minh Tuan and all the panelists who would like to answer. I'd like to tie together the human trafficking and also the nuclear and all the high-tech trafficking in Southeast Asia, especially in Vietnam. Dr. Tha Minh Tuan has pointed out that we have very porous borders, and especially the borders between Vietnam and China. And especially in the case of human trafficking, Vietnamese females and ladies have been known to significantly being transported through this porous border between China and Vietnam. The Vietnamese government have any policy toward that? Now, the same token to what all other traffickings, all other materials, especially nuclear and high technologies, and with the concern of increasing Chinese aggressions in the Southeast Asian Sea and all the challenges you pointed out, is there any policy you would suggest the Vietnamese government to think about, or work toward?
Well, first of all, on the trafficking across Vietnam's China border, it's serious. That's well known, and it's open secret in Vietnam's. In terms of government policy, I would say yes. A number of policies have been made by the governments, you know, at various levels, from the central governments to local governments. The problems with all this policy is that, you know, as I indicated in my presentations, law enforcement is relatively weak, particularly the law enforcement officers. You know, they are somehow not quite well equipped with with the issues. You know, how they can do it, and as you I mentioned, and you also agree that the border is really porous. We have around 1,400 kilometers border lines with China's, and more than longer than that, with Cambodia's and Laos, and most borders in Vietnam are high mountains, and you don't really have a clear markers of borders, so, and people live alongside the borders for hundreds, thousands of, maybe thousands of years. They have relatives cross the border, so just cross the border, just as wading through the stream or rivers, something. So it's difficult, and the policy is very much there. Some so-called socials, organizations like women unions, youth unions. They are really very much on these issues, but I would say the best guess is that the efforts is there, but not very much successful because of the very severeness of the issues, the high demand on the Chinese side, and on the Vietnamese side, frankly speaking, the level of education is pretty low, and most people who are cheated into this kind of business, they did not know that they are going to be smuggled and forced into a marriage in southern China or even in the brothel. So it's very complicated. So I would say the bottom line is policy is there, but the enforcement is relatively weak. The problems is acute, and I would cite an example is that we have more than 100,000 Vietnamese brides in Taiwan, and not all of them going to Taiwan with a proper marriage status. So this is kind of big issues. Regarding to nuclear materials or things like that, I would say so far in Vietnam, we haven't seen any kind of this illicit trade yet, because Vietnam is not yet a nuclear country, even though we are going to build a nuclear power plants, but not in 10 years' time. So I haven't seen or heard anything about the nuclear smuggling in there. And on your last part of questions, I think perhaps it's not a really a good venues for that kind of discussions on these questions, but maybe we can talk it offline. Thank you.
May I add some response? I think there between China, India, Vietnam, Laos, India, Myanmar, there's a total 4,000 kilometers border. This is very how to make the border control. I think we cannot follow like the American-Mexico border. We cannot construct a new Great Wall, I think. So that's but if we compared with these several countries border with China, Vietnam, Laos, and Myanmar, I think the Vietnam government they do better actually. Because there's drug issues and human trafficking issues, they can still under control, I think. If compared with Myanmar, there's more serious, because many trafficking cases, actually, this victims' parents did not get a report to the police in Myanmar because of the technique of transport communication or something else reason. So I think they're, Vietnamese, if we compare to the several countries, I think Vietnamese government is a better job, I think.
I have different opinion. I think the Vietnamese government is not doing enough to help their people, the overseas. In Taiwan, yes, we have the biggest group of foreign spouses as Vietnamese. And I have to tell you, because in Taiwan, we have special funds earmarked for, you know, helping those foreign spouses to integrate, to be integrated into the society. So now the Vietnamese spouses organized probably the most active foreign spouses group. And even in some of the government committees, we have outside members that they are Vietnamese spouses. And many Vietnamese spouses, they were trained to be interpreter to help the foreign neighbors into Taiwan. But I do see, you know, Vietnamese victims, they at first they were not trafficked into Taiwan. They were trafficked to China, then re-trafficked from inland to, you know, Fujian or the coastal, and then traffic to Taiwan for better pay or something like that. And after we rescued them, it's very hard to find, the Vietnamese will always say, oh, well, we cannot locate their whereabouts, their families. And it's very hard to find a local NGO who can help them if we, you know, help them to return to their home country. So there's some special cases that we try to make them citizens in Taiwan now. Okay, thank you.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you very much for your participation and excellent questions. And above all, let me thank my co-panelists. We are very sad to be losing them at Brookings, but we have learned enormously and hope to continue our exchange of ideas.
Happens to be the last day that my four visiting fellows are going to be with us. It's the end of their term. Their home organizations were very generous about lending them to Brookings, but for some reason they want them back now. So I hope that you will join me in wishing them safe travels and good luck. Thank you. And please enjoy your summer. Thank you.